We hear Ken Tucker hearing Secret Harmonies every Wednesday at about 3:40. And for the next few weeks, while Ken is running around covering rock festivals and concerts for the Philadelphia Inquirer, which he writes for, we are hearing programs from the Hearing Secret Harmonies archives. Next week, by the way, Ken's program will be on Allen Ginsberg. It's a minute after 4 o'clock, and you're listening to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is the National Public Radio Station in Philadelphia. Terry Gross is on vacation. It's her third day of vacation. It's also the third day and the final day of the National Public Radio Drive to Survive fundraiser. As you know, NPR came very close to having to close its doors last week. At the last minute, it was saved by a loan from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But the long and the short of it is, NPR needs to raise money now to pay back CPB and to keep their programs like All Things Considered and Morning Edition as strong as they have been in the past. So we urge you to join NPR listeners all over the country who have been calling in and calling in their local NPR stations, and join us here now at 923-1234 to make a pledge. We have phone volunteers who are here, and because today is the last day, we're expecting an outpouring of calls during All Things Considered. And if you're listening to the radio now, if you're listening to us now, please join us at 923-1234. That's area code 215, and you can call collect. Join us before the lines get clogged up during All Things Considered, and our thanks to everybody who has called. My next guest has spent about 3 decades in the film industry and has also been a treasured faculty member on the TV and Film Study faculties of UCLA, Temple University, the University of Iowa, and currently is a professor in the School of Communication at the University of Houston, a program which he founded. One of his colleagues there is Garth Jowett, who was a guest yesterday afternoon on Fresh Air. Ray Fielding has also written extensively. His titles include The American Newsreel, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in Letters in 1973, The March of Time, published in 1978, and The Technique of Special Effects Cinematography, which has been in print for 18 years and was recently published in Japanese. He is in Philadelphia to lecture at a week-long seminar on freedom and mass communication, sponsored by the Valley Forge-based Freedom Foundation. This program is one of many seminars which the Freedom Foundation organizes. Next week, August 7th through 12th, there'll be a program on freedom and literature. For more information on these seminars, you can call the program office at the Freedom Foundation at 933-8825. Ray Fielding knows an incredible amount about special visual effects and has worked closely with film director Francis Ford Coppola as a consultant on Apocalypse Now and as the founder and director of Zoetrope Images, which has provided special visual effects for Zoetrope productions like The Black Stallion, The Outsiders, and the recently released Hammett. He was a special visual effects supervisor for Coppola's One from the Heart and worked closely with him in developing a new approach using computers, information storage and retrieval systems, and video techniques to pre-visualize, script, and plan the production of films at Zoetrope Studios. Well, it's a real pleasure to have you here, Ray Fielding.
It's a pleasure to be back here in Philadelphia.
That's right, from Temple University.
All right.
As the director of technical development and special effects with Coppola at Zoetrope, what were you called on to do there?
Well, we had a grand opportunity to try to realize some of Francis's ambitions, some of the dreams that he had had, some of the things he and I had talked about for many years, which was to return to the studio after many years in which filmmakers went out into the real world, which had its advantages. But he had dreamed of going back into the studios to recreate the kind of film that was produced, say, in the 1920s at the great UFA studios in Germany, in the 1930s at Fox in Hollywood. And also, above all, to try to reduce the cost of making motion pictures. You know, Variety reports that the average cost of the feature film today is $9,600,000, which is insane. What Francis constructed was a concept, a notion. It was technologically based, it was artistically motivated, and above all, it sought to reduce the cost of films, to increase the number of films that were made, to give more opportunities, as you know, as he's very keen on doing, to young filmmakers, foreign filmmakers, to produce unusual films on subjects that have a somewhat smaller audience and which otherwise would not be created. And the only way he felt that this could be done was to create his own studios, to return to Los Angeles. As you know, he has for many years operated out of San Francisco, which is where the corporation Zoetrope Studios is based. And so in 1979, in the spring, I went out to his home at Napa Valley, and we spent some time planning his return to Los Angeles. And in the summer of 1979, we came down to Los Angeles, and he made arrangements for purchase of a studio, an old studio, at which I had worked when I was a young man. It was then called Hollywood General, the first stages of which were erected in 1921. a grand old studio on about 9 acres of land, 9 sound stages, very well equipped, into which ultimately we were to put about $2 million worth of refurbishing to bring it up to date. And it was his dream to create a state-of-the-art studio, bringing to bear what others had tried to do immediately after the Second World War and failed because the technology was not yet ready to marry electronics and photochemistry and mechanical engineering.
Well, that's basically what you did in something called an electronic armature.
Right.
Can you briefly describe that?
Right. This is a metaphor that he uses, the electronic armature, which is like the dummy or the framework that a sculptor creates, and he clothes it as he saw it with all of the operations, electronic operations, which enhance and assist the making of a conventional motion picture, all the way from the creation of the script and what is called the assistant director's breakdown, which is a logistical breakdown of great complexity, which we never got around to, but which would have been computerized. No one has gotten around to it yet. It's really much more complicated than it seems, but which is ideally suited to the computer. Leading next to a technique which he first employed on The Conversation and then on Apocalypse Now, in which he creates with his performers in the sound studio a radio play. He takes the script in whatever draft he finds it, and they read it as one would in the old days on radio with sound effects and music on a separate track. So you can take music out, you can bring it back, change the music, change the effects. That gives him the basic armature. It gives him the timings. It gives him the structure of the script in audio. Then he asked for, and there was constructed by the electronics group, what he calls the pre-visualization machine. It's an electronic storyboard. Now, storyboards have been with us for decades. Everybody, almost everyone, uses them, especially the big studios. They are a way of pre-visualizing the setups that will be achieved by the director on stage. It's a way of anticipating problems and visualizing the individual shots and the coverage of particular scenes ahead of time. He constructed, we took a room out of the studio and built it into what he called the war room, because it looks like the invasion of Normandy in the Second World War, filled with the sketches, altogether hundreds, thousands of them by sketch artists, individual sequences being positioned on particular pinboards up on the wall. And of course, this is a conventional storyboard used in animation, used in feature films. In fact, some directors like the late Alfred Hitchcock used to argue in his way, his sly way, that as I've heard him say, everything that's creative, he says, is done on the storyboard. And what is left when we go on to the soundstage is merely routine. Well, of course, he was exaggerating, but it was his way of working, and it exemplified his approach to things. Meticulous pre-planning, not only in the service of art, but in the service of business as well, to reduce the unnecessary movement, unnecessary building of sets, and all the rest of it. So he built what he called the war room, the walls filled with these sketches. And as changes are made, as he reviews, he walks back and forth, he and his production designer, the cinematographer, the supervisors of special effects, the set construction people. He can remove drawings. He can replace them. He can move whole sections. He can say that scene isn't working. We need something new. I need additional sketches. And the sketch artists would walk back and forth with him. But now we took this a step further. What he envisioned was an electronic reproduction. And we took the guts out of an electronic editor that he had used in the editing of Apocalypse Now and created, I say we, the engineering people, created a console, a desk about as big as what we're sitting at here, maybe 8 feet long and about 5 feet deep, with monitors, television-type monitors across the bottom and a master monitor at top, and later for group viewing, a projection television monitor that would project onto a 6-by-8-foot screen at the other end of the room. And there would be this is a computer-controlled, computer-memoried outfit. It incorporated two so-called video frame store disk systems, which could hold, I think, altogether 800, each 800 still drawings or photographs or Polaroids, what have you. And he first pumped into the audio part of this, because it can operate in synchronous, of course, with a number of soundtracks, rough soundtracks. He pump in that radio play that he's recorded. That gives him his timings and the structure. Then, after the initial approval of all of the drawings around the room, these were taken off. They were numbered and removed, hundreds of them, and each was photographed separately with a video camera and was pumped into an individual frame position, an address in that frame store. Once they're in there, once they're in memory, they can be removed instantaneously in a nanosecond. The computer will draw them out.
So basically what you have is a computer storage system where the both the audio part from the radio play and the pictures, either from the still shot on the set or from whatever film shot or from the pictures in the war room, are you have the movie there before it's shot.
Exactly. And what is unique about it, what I want to stress, I don't think it's ever been done before, is that you end up editing the film before you shoot it. It's a difference in kind rather than degree. It's unlike any kind of storyboard ever made. And of course, you can also, there were also 3/4-inch video cassette, a bank of them, so that you could punch up instantaneously rough footage, video footage. I might say, and it would take a long time to describe the whole process because it's a philosophical concept which has economic implications. It required, in theater style, extensive rehearsal of the actors, first on a bare stage and then with just apple boxes to take the place of the furniture and the sets, then in the rough set, over and over and over, extensive rehearsals, perfection of the performance. And these, in time, were recorded with a video camera, one single camera and a VCR, portable portapack, and this would be pumped into the storyboard to replace the sketches. Sometimes Polaroid shots would be. And, of course, we in the special visual effects department were generating tests, and that would be sent over, and that would be pumped in. We also constructed for him what's called an Ultimat compositor, which is based upon a electronic device developed by a man named Petro Vlahos, which allowed for the first time in film work, in a really sophisticated kind of way, for the special effects crew, the director, the production designer, and the cinematographer to see what the composite, these very complicated special effects shots, will look like when they are done later using high-quality film. One of the problems with special effects, which hardly ever anybody ever notes, is that directors don't ordinarily like them, for the very good reason that they have to turn over to someone else the creative responsibilities of the sequence, and no director wants to do that. They have to wait several days, at least 24, 48 hours. Sometimes, in the case of 2001 of Kubrick's, that were held negative, that were held for half a year before they finally made the final composite, before they could see whether they had anything. Many of the Lucas films made in recent years, the live action that was shot in England, was shot without the actors and the director knowing yet precisely what was going to go into the rest of the image. That was all created later, back in Marin County and near San Francisco. So the Ultimat, of which we had two units, quite expensive units, one that could be moved from stage to stage, the other was built to connect into the pre-visualization machine, the story machine, so that we could see these composites. And he says, I don't like the background. Could you bring it in faster? Try another background. Try that thing we tried yesterday. And instantaneously, or in a few moments, you load up the new background and you try it out.
And that's because all the elements are computer-controlled and you just
exactly.
Log it to, I see.
Exactly. And gradually, there begins to assemble, in motion picture form, before your very eyes, the more finely designed motion picture as it will look, which has not yet even been photographed.
How do you think all this pre-visualization affects the way directors have traditionally made choices as characters evolve, as concepts for the visual look of the film evolve? Because it's all on his own ground, and you don't have the growth of everybody else on the crew along with it.
Oh, no, I disagree. Well, it depends upon the director. Francis, bless his heart, is the kind of person who not only allows for suggestions, he will collar you and haul you into the into the room and say, take a look at this and tell me what you think of it. He wants suggestions. And the virtue of the system, of course, there's almost unlimited memory in the computer, and he has his own selection, of course, but each of us would come in. The musician, Tom Waits, would come in, the production designer, and we'd fool with it after hours. You can't hurt the computer. And we would punch, I say we, Wally Gentleman, our supervising supervisor, would come in, and each of these very, and the editor, of course, would come in, and by the next morning they might have a variation, or they'd say, I've got a great idea. Maybe it was great, maybe it wasn't, but why don't we do this? So the next morning there'd be something new for him to look at, And it's merely memory A, memory B, memory 25, memory 26. You can always go back to it. Unlimited memory for all practical purposes. A very versatile machine. I might say that people came in from all over Los Angeles to look at it. And although some components of this so-called electronic armature of Francis's were a little controversial, this particular feature, my impression is that everyone was very excited about it. It is the only such unit that I know of in the world, and it's still being used by him on films that he's just completed, Rumblefish and The Outsiders, and now three new films that he's contracted for. But I have a feeling that other studios, when they see its utility, when they appreciate its value, will perhaps wish to duplicate it. Now, the armature, of course, as I say, was a system. It also involved the use, as we move towards technical rehearsal, again in drama terms, in theater terms, a technical rehearsal using cameras, either one camera, two or three, occasionally multiple cameras in television style, which had video taps on them, which take off. We built for him, the electronics people did, a van, cost about $1 million, I guess, one-of-a-kind sort of thing, in which he would sit several blocks away from the soundstage and would see the actual image that was being or would be recorded the moment the motion picture camera turned over or was turning over. It would be produced, and it would be recorded at that moment on half-inch beta format videotape. What this allowed him to do, as no one has ever done before, after he had made a take or several takes, till he gets to the point where he thinks he has a piece of film, a take during production that looks good, he could then almost instantaneously, within a matter of a few moments, cut it, try it with something that was shot 2 weeks ago, which he punches up to see whether it cuts together both physically in the sense of the image and the way in which it goes together on the screen, but also thematically, timing, rhythms, and structure, or something that was shot that will follow it. He could also blend in and out the music. There was almost a return to silent picture days, because sometimes he would pipe into the stage the music which had been selected for the bridge, and the instant before the actors began to perform and their voices to be recorded, they would cut it out so it wouldn't contaminate the soundtrack.
What type of sense do you have on the... you're on this 9 acres of Zoetrope Studios, and there's one person in master control with all of the other, you know, accessory people working with him, sort of directing the show. How does that seem on the set?
Well, it's very eccentric. Of course, we all get used to it. This is very much a family sort of thing with Francis Coppola. He collects around him people who have been with him for many years, people he's known, and he brings in many young people, untried people.
Many family members, too, I understand.
Yes, indeed. It is literally a family as well as an artistic family. So if you trust him, if you like him, if you enjoy working with him, then you accept his idiosyncratic way of working. It is unusual. It's very curious. I don't mean to say that people talk about the Vox Cathedra, the voice from the rafters, which comes in over the loudspeaker. He's several blocks away talking to you. He has an expression. He says, "I speak to the television screen and it does what I tell it." But, of course, he comes in from time to time to sit down and talk. It's not working. Why isn't it working? Let's see if we can, you know, the things that directors always do when things don't seem to quite work. The point is, and here we move into a much more controversial, an artistically controversial area, that this style of filmmaking has both economic and artistic consequences. On the one hand, if it is to be used the way he intended it, it means that the actors and actresses and performers must be on contract, because they work with him over a period of many, many weeks, just as you do in theater. And, of course, this is not practical if you're dealing with stars. What this means is, I think that it was never his intention. Who am I to speak for him? But I think the system suggests that, in the main, what he was trying to do was to create a studio system which would also benefit new, fresh talent rather than stars. I have to say that the star system today is one in which the cost of stars and what these very talented people demand in the way of financial recompense is so staggering that it's making the production of films very difficult. These people, I might say, my understanding is the contracts that these people enjoyed with him were very generous, which allowed them to work for other people. But these were people who were on contract on a yearly basis and who were available week after week, a family studio system of people. He talks about a repertory company. He talks about the medieval notion, the medieval tradition of craftsmen, a community of craftsmen working together. maybe not making colossal sums of money in the Hollywood tradition, but doing certainly well enough, and turning out a career's worth of fine work. Well, that was the dream, and I think it's still a viable plan, even though momentarily the studio fell on hard times. I might say that the final step of the electronic armature was an electronic editing machine, and that was constructed for him, our own unique machine. There are others, very good ones. I think the one that was built for him was exceptionally good, very versatile. And I understand, whereas that was Mark I, model Mark I, I understand they now have an improvement of it, which was used on Rumblefish and The Outsiders. So the technology goes forward.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Ray Fielding, who has worked with Francis Ford Coppola for the last few years in a couple of different capacities. He's the founder and director of Zoetrope Images, which produces special visual effects that are used in Zoetrope productions, and was the visual effects supervisor for Coppola's One from the Heart, a film which unfortunately has not made it to Philadelphia.
No.
Briefly in New York, and just has been yanked from distribution. We're going to be speaking about One from the Heart for the next few minutes, so I thought what I'd do is read a synopsis from a New Yorker article, an interview with Francis Ford Coppola, this to give our listeners and myself a sense of what the film's about, since it hasn't been seen in Philadelphia, by Lillian Ross. It reads, One from the Heart is the story of an unmarried couple, Franny and Hank, who have been living together in a small house in Las Vegas for 5 years and are dissatisfied with each other. Franny works for a travel agency and daydreams about going to Bora Bora and finding a man to go there with her. Hank runs an automobile repair shop and junkyard and daydreams about having a romantic alliance with a glamorous girl. They have brief alliances with other partners, Franny with a singing waiter who does indeed want to go to Bora Bora with her, and Hank with a seductive young tightrope walker from a circus family. Hank then wants to get together with Franny again. After some resistance and turmoil, she returns to him, and that's that. And that's the description of One from the Heart from an article by Lillian Ross. I understand that the set for One from the Heart was quite amazing. Could you describe it?
It was extraordinary. Now, remember that what Francis was trying to demonstrate, especially in this first film, was that a film could be made, as it used to be made in the old days, totally within the confines of a studio. The film, and it is not my place to interpret the film for Francis Coppola. He can do that best for himself, but I'll do so anyway, my own impression of it and my recollection of what his intention was and what we tried to realize for him. It was intended, I think, as a lightweight divertissement, a love story, and one, a film that would show off the technological hardware, the new advances in technology that would be elegant to the eye, that would be a beautiful film to look at, and that above all would demonstrate the feasibility of his system, the electronic armature system, working within a studio. And indeed, the final film, when and if you have a chance to see it, is visually elegant. It got very good reviews. Its photography, its art direction, the sets are magnificent, in some respects unique. The special effects, I'm happy to say, got good reviews. The critics have differed with regard to the story. It is not a heavyweight story, unlike some of his other works. It's meant as a divertissement. The sets, actually all nine stages were filled with sets, all nine of them all at once. The whole studio was tied up for it. The location is Las Vegas, and the film has nothing to do with gambling. I don't know if he has ever addressed this publicly, but amongst ourselves, he said that every civilization has, as a symbol, somewhere in its consciousness or unconsciousness, a magic city in the desert, at which wonderful things happen. And among the wonderful things are love stories. And love stories have their unhappy aspects, too. And so this was the point of departure, not only the thematic, but the visual point of departure. And he wanted a film that would show off, in visual effects and in set direction, everything that we were capable of. And, of course, he had the very best people working with him. Dean Tavalaris, who was a brilliant set director, who won his Academy Award for Apocalypse Now, who's done many other things with Francis. Vittorio Storaro, two-time Academy Award winner for Reds and for Apocalypse Now for director of photography. Wally Gentleman, whom I brought into the organization to, and then later Robert Swarth, both outstanding special visual effects artists, just the very best people to work on this. Now, we could have gone, Francis could have gone to Las Vegas and photographed the Las Vegas backgrounds at a fraction of what it cost. That Las Vegas neon set I do not know what it costs, nor I have an idea, but I think it's not my place to say. It costs far more than it should have. But it is such an elegant, it's in storage, by the way. It can be resurrected any time one wishes. And there has never been such a display of neon. We had to bring in thousands of amperes of additional current that the city brought in just to operate the thing. It is just one of the most elegant sets that's ever been put together. And it, together with the visual effects, together with the control over set design, works beautifully. Somewhere along the line, because of other factors, most of which were external to the studio, going into business at the wrong time, at the time that interest rates were rising throughout the world, and you will remember that the motion picture industry is interest rate sensitive because all of our money is borrowed money. A lot of things went wrong for him, which made it impossible for him to continue to operate the studio as it was intended. But not only was One from the Heart finished, but also the work of other young filmmakers whom he sought to sponsor. Caleb Deschanel, who in his first directorial assignment, Escape Artist, Caleb did the wonderful photography on Black Stallion, a very talented 29-year-old cinematographer now turned director. Wim Wenders' Hammett, which is a very interesting film. These are smaller audience types films. They may do well in the large audience, and that would be very nice indeed for Francis, but they were intended to showcase new talent. We had altogether 18 films in preparation. Of course, overseas, The Return of Black Stallion was under preparation. And many other, David Lynch and I and the others in the effects group were beginning to work on a project of his, a very unusual, extraordinary story. I'm afraid it'll never be made now, called Ronnie Rocket. But, of course, all of these things finally unraveled and the money did not become available. Mr. Lynch has now moved on to Universal, where he's making Dune for Dino De Laurentiis, and which I understand will be a very exciting film. One of the ironies of this whole situation is that the special visual effects facility, which I purchased, negotiated, created for Francis, which operated until the very last days because we had outside clients, it was a going concern, when the studio had to close down, reverted to its original owners, they reacquired it, and I'm now associated with them. So the work goes on, and of course, the whole area of special visual effects is a very interesting one.
As feeling, I'm sure as many other filmgoers do, that Philadelphia, amongst other cities, was neglected in at least the initial small release of One from the Heart, could you just briefly tell us what went wrong? The film was made. There was a film show.
Oh, yes. Oh, indeed, yes. For example, it's done quite well in Europe. I was in Stockholm, and they told me it had run there for a month. Did quite well. Got good reviews.
What were the marketing problems in America? Why didn't it get shown?
I'm not entirely sure I can answer to that, because that's not my domain. One of the peculiarities of the film, hardly ever mentioned, is that it was shot in a 1.33:1 aspect ratio, which is the old movie tone aspect ratio, which prevailed up through the 60s until we finally standardized either on CinemaScope at 2.35:1 or what most theaters are set up for, which is 1.85:1. You realize to shoot a film in 1.33:1 is a daring, it's a foolhardy, one might say a foolhardy exercise, because very few theaters find themselves set up with the lenses, the screens, the masking, and the apertures for that old-time aperture. It's the same aperture we find on television. Nothing wrong with it. It's a fine aperture. In fact, Francis grows passionate when he talks about the decision, the commercial decision of exhibitors years ago, to change a perfectly good aperture, 1.33:1, which is approximately 4x5 or 8x10, to this widescreen for merely commercial purposes.
To compete with television?
Right. And it was his intention not only, some things that are still in the works, and the company goes on, Francis goes on, he's still very active, but there are one or two black and white productions in the plan. He wants to try to break some of these exhibition conventions and also remind us that we had some wonderful things in the 20s and 30s that we've forgotten about. Very few people have seen, for that matter, a high-quality black and white print projected on with fine projection apparatus onto a large motion picture screen. For that matter, almost all of the prints we see in black and white, Woody Allen's Manhattan and the rest, are printed on color stocks, and only the showcase prints and the archive prints are printed on black and white stock.
So what do you lose in that?
Well, you lose richness. You lose black blacks, white, brilliant whites that don't block up, and you don't lose the shadows and the blacks, and a brilliant range of grays, grayscale, far in excess of color, of course. It glows, it luminesces, if the projection situation is right, as it used to be. I mean, when you went to the theaters in the old days, you saw brilliant, luminescent black and white films. I remember them from my youth. And now we see very fine color films, and that's splendid. But what he's saying is just as in art, you have a variety of media and ways of painting a picture or watercoloring it, so we should have some variety in film. Unfortunately, economics of film do not lend themselves to that. That's one of the problems. As you may know, the RCA is releasing that film in video cassette, which is a 1.3:1 ratio. It's a television ratio. The prints, so far as I'm aware, and I really shouldn't render a judgment because I'm not in touch with the release, but the only prints that were available in this country for showcase presentation were 70mm 1.3:1 prints, and I've in Los Angeles and New York, many other cities, and it was really quite a fine screening. It looked gorgeous. It was an exciting experience. The reaction from the critics, including the premiere at Radio City Music Hall, was mixed. Some people were quite excited by it. Especially overseas, the European critics were quite taken by it. For some reason or other, and I'm not the one to, or I haven't had the time to even think it through, but for some reason or other, European critics find in Francis's very personal way of making films some qualities which are more European, whatever that means. The American critics, very mixed, and although they all admired it, although they all also recognized that it would probably, I suppose, get out on the history books as as the pioneer film in new technology, although they loved the set direction and the rest of it. It's a feast for the eyes, but not everyone was happy with the story, and there was a lot of quibbling about this and that. So for reasons best known to himself, he has decided to delay the theater release in 35mm, which means they'll have to reprint it to an 1.85 aperture. And I'm sure he will release it in time, maybe in maybe next year, 1984.
I should point out that I think I did read somewhere that a couple of people who studied marketing promotion strategies recommended stressing
exactly
the visual and the special effects
exactly
nature of it, that,
yes,
that being one of the really unique things
exactly
about the film.
Yep. We found, I might say, by the way, that in theater tradition, Francis places a great deal of reliance on previews. And the people who advise him have always suggested Seattle, Washington, for whatever demographic reasons seem appropriate. And he found that audiences were very excited. We did unusual things. I say we, he did. He showed preview audiences well ahead of time unfinished prints of One from the Heart with blow-ups to 35 from the rather coarse television screen on the pre-visualization storyboard machine, and the audiences loved it.
Were you at the Radio City Music Hall preview?
No, I couldn't make it. No, I saw the screening in Los Angeles a couple weeks later.
Well, let's talk about a film that I think a lot of people have seen in Philadelphia and probably all over the world at this point, Apocalypse Now.
Mm.
Well, you were called in as a consultant.
I was called
effects
in at the very beginning, but I did not play a part in the production of it, although the same group of people, of course, worked with him. It was a... I think it is an outstanding film. I think it's a classic, and I think it will be remembered and will emerge with the passing of years increasingly as a classic. It was for a number of reasons, an agonizing experience for all of them, and those who have read Elena Coppola's book Notes will have an intimate day-by-day account of the frustrations that were encountered. He was in touch with me when I was at Temple University here in Philadelphia, I think perhaps around 1974, 75 or so, and we talked. He said, I've been thinking again about the things we used to talk about, going back into the studio. He had just finished Godfather 2 and was on promotion, on tour, to promote the film, and he said, I weary of shooting on location. It tires me, it fatigues me, I'm getting ripped off in 100 different ways, I'm being compromised. To try to shoot on location, I yearned to go back into the studio, or to go into the studio for the first time in my life and to do the things we used to talk about. And he said, I have a new property we've been talking about for years. In fact, Lucas was originally scheduled to direct it and then tired of waiting and went off by himself. And he said, it's called Apocalypse Now. And I said, what a curious title. So he sent the script out. He said, would you do a special effects breakdown? I'd be interested in your judgment. So I did so on the assumption that he would shoot it at Burbank or 20th Century Fox or somewhere. And in his typically unpredictable fashion, he disappeared and surfaced 10 months later in the Philippines and experienced nothing but, of course, grave problems, some of his own making, which were dictated the moment he selected the jungle to shoot, to photograph such a film.
What does that set himself up against? It's a hot, wet, humid environment.
Yes, against nature itself. He wanted to... Well, there are many peculiarities of the film. I don't feel like going into a lot of detail. I'll leave that to him. I think they're proprietary in nature. But he wanted to shoot it in many different areas in the United States. He wanted to shoot it in some foreign countries. He sent a team around the world with video camera and still camera to research it. I've talked to them. I've seen their reports. In the end, on a trip to the Philippines, he was very much taken with the aspect, the look, which looked like Cambodia, like the Vietnam countryside, which he was familiar with. And it was his decision in the end to shoot it there, and it turned out to be a bad decision. I mean, nothing wrong with the Philippines, but they had to carve out jungle trails. It was madness. He thought he could do something like Teddy Roosevelt in the early part of the century, going off on his African expedition and returning a broken man.
What did he have to do to modify the jungle just so you could get movie cameras in there and shoot a film?
Fly them in by helicopter or carve trails out of the mountains. He did not anticipate the problems. He built the jungle, temple, which appears at the end of the film, promising the Philippine government that he would restore the land to the condition, of course, in which he found it. And because of the schedule, they thought they could get it filmed before the rainy season came, but they didn't. The rainy season came. They were under 5 feet of water. They had to rebuild the whole temple 30 feet higher, so that what you see is the second rebuilding of that set. It was this set more than anything else that convinced him it was time to go back to the techniques of special effects of the 20s and 30s, and instead of building real solid sets to create them visually. We'd been doing it for 30, 40 years, and he had been schooled in a different tradition. He came into and out of the UCLA Film School at a time when, after the Second World War, for very good reasons, artistic and thematic reasons, filmmakers had left the studio. They wanted something fresh. There were also economic reasons. There were frozen dollars overseas, and there were extras in Spain and Italy that could be had at one-tenth the cost of extras for extravaganzas in Hollywood. So there were economic and artistic reasons for getting out, and that was all he had known. That was how he was trained. But now he had become aware, he's a very well-educated person, and he's familiar, intimately familiar with the history of the film, and he knew that films used to be shot differently.
Did you teach him at UCLA?
I did.
And George Lucas and all that?
No, not Lucas. Lucas was from USC. And, in fact, I've never met Lucas, very talented person. So many very talented people, but I might say not only from UCLA and USC now, the first of the people from Temple, students of mine from Iowa, Nicholas Mayo, wrote 7.5% Solution, did Time After Time, did Star Trek II. There's about a 5 to 10 year lag before the first graduates of a film school begin to find their way either to New York or to, of course, many of them go into other excellent specializations. You don't have to go to Hollywood, but many of them take some about 5 to 10 years. And, of course, USC has been in business for 50 years and UCLA for about 35.
Well, I'd like to ask you about One Shot. I know you weren't there, but let me ask you, because of your expertise in special effects, it's not the opening shot, but near to the opening of Apocalypse Now, and I think it's the shot over which the title Apocalypse Now appears, is a long shot in the jungle. It's spectacular. You see the napalm shooting up, and it's traversing the jungle, going from one side of the screen
right
to the other. It's slow motion, but it's gorgeous, and I imagine created a lot of logistical nightmares just to pull that shot off. How
right
was that done?
It was done with gasoline. The director of pyrotechnics was a man named A.D. Flowers, now retired, who was one of the grand old men of pyrotechnic mechanical effects. This was one of the areas in which he had asked me to consult when we did the special effects breakdown originally. And because napalm is nasty stuff, it's not available to the civilians anyway. I had called his attention to footage that I had seen for years, saw regularly photographed by the Air Force and by their contractors of napalm drops, which I might say was not made available to him. The script was not very suitable for Pentagon purposes. So it had to be simulated with gasoline. I think that he says that was the largest. Incidentally, he emphasizes that they set it off long before the gasoline shortage became apparent in this country and throughout the world way back in the 70s. But he said it was the largest gasoline explosion ever attempted. And, of course, this is done partly electrically with detonators and vast amounts of flowing gasoline. Also very dangerous material. Actually, there are no titles under that sequence. You recall the titles come at the end of the film. There are five different versions. I've seen four of them. And at the time I joined the company 3 years later, he was just finishing it in the final cut and agonizing over the title, which, as you recall, was the most argued about part of the film as far as the critics were concerned. I preferred the ending, which I gather he did, in which the disposition of Martin Sheen's character, or the final decision, is not revealed.
Somewhat ambiguous.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, you leave him on the steps, and having killed Kurtz, and you do not know what his decision will be. A second took him back to the boat. He goes down the river, but you do not know what he will do after that. The third, he calls in an airstrike, and they blow up the temple. I might say that the distributor, of course, also had a strong influence over him because they felt that the audience required a clear conclusion to the film. So he arrived at a compromise. The 70mm version has no titles and no machine goes down to the boat and goes off down the river. And that's it. And you get a program.
You get a program, right.
And the 35mm version, you have a posterized special effects ending with extensive titles with all the footage they shot of the blowing up of the temple. So the implication is that the airstrike has been called in.
Well, like the temple blowing up or that opening shot with the gasoline, how far ahead does the planning start for that?
Oh, weeks, months. One of the principles of special effects, any kind of special effects, whether visual, which is my field, or mechanical, which is others, explosions, gunshots, rain, fog, anything that miniature explosions. There are specialists in prosthetic makeup, which is a form of mechanical effect. Principle of all kind of effects is that you plan it as early as possible and then you lock it in, because changes which occur later are terribly expensive. This, by the way, is one of the reasons that the budget on One from the Heart went up, because Francis was experimenting. He was using entirely new technology, and it was not possible, to our frustration, for him to lock in some of these things, so that about the time, for One from the Heart, a $250,000 miniature of Las Vegas was built over a six-month period. We spent 2 months photographing it, and I think in the finished film, although it's very elegant, it looks beautiful, but I think only about a minute of running footage of all of that work, of that type of special effect appears in. There are all kinds of effects in the film.
Let me reintroduce you for people just joining us. I'm speaking with Ray Fielding, who has worked for the past few years with Francis Ford Coppola at Zoetrope Studios, where he has consulted on special effects and supervised the special effects for the production of One from the Heart, the special visual effects. And we've been speaking about Apocalypse Now. I'm just wondering, how much time did Marlon Brando spend on that production? Because it's really a horrendous place to live in the jungle.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I imagine somebody, Brando, might not have wanted to be around too long.
Well, he was in and out over a period of about a year. Incidentally, there are many sequences in which he appears, which I have not seen, the plantation sequence, which they say is the best sequence in the film. But as I understand it, the distributor felt the film was running much too long, so they had to cut it down. As you probably also know, Martin Sheen had a heart attack. Everything went wrong. There was a typhoon. The sets were destroyed. There was a great deal of question whether their insurance coverage would cover you have to understand that to be a film director of the type of Francis, an outstanding director working under these kind of conditions, requires not only talent, but the will, the tenacity, and the faith of an army general. Because everybody looks to the director to hold everything together. The pressures on him were simply staggering.
I always wondered how he directed Brando, because Colonel Kurtz, the character, seemed like such an impenetrable character that just didn't communicate.
Right.
He was in his own world, and that somewhat resembled the public persona of what Marlon Brando's like.
That may very well be. I have never worked with Mr. Brando. Of course, he's a fine artist. It's my understanding that he can sometimes be a difficult person to work with. He brings his own experience and his own vision to the parts he plays. And it's my understanding that a director must be, on the one hand, diplomatic, but very strong to deal with him, as Francis is. And I was not present, of course, during the making of Apocalypse, so I really can't testify about the day-to-day affairs.
Well, let's talk a little bit about special effects and another large part of your background, and I guess that encompasses things that are very spectacular, but also things which, if done well, the pride is in people not seeing what's
done. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, amongst the my colleague with whom I'm presently associated in Hollywood, an organization called Film Effects International, which is a reincorporation of the old, grand old company of Film Effects of Hollywood, my colleague will next year celebrate his 50th anniversary in the film industry, Don Weed. And amongst both the young people, some of whom are very young in their teens, and amongst the older veterans as well, this recent celebrity which they have enjoyed is flattering, and they are appreciative, but they are also puzzled and a little concerned, because one of the great prides of special effects people is in creating the art of the film, which is the art of illusion. They speak of there's a word in filmmaking called a cheat. Everything is a cheat. It's an artistic cheat. And to be able to fool the audience so that they don't know that they're watching. When you see a ship go out into outer space, when you see an airplane crash 20 feet from the camera on a battlefield, common sense tells you that it's a special effects shot, however it is accomplished, because you could not photograph it, you could not bring a camera there when it happened, you lose half the people on the set.
Well, share with us some examples that you don't
right.
see that you like.
One of my favorite examples is done by another colleague of mine, now retired, Linwood Dunn, the grand old man of special effects, who for many years was head of special effects at RKO. He did Citizen Kane, Magnificent Ambersons, hundreds of films, one of the best of which is a light comedy with Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant called Bringing Up Baby, in which the premise of this silly story, charming story, is that this couple have a trained lion or a jaguar of substantial size and substantial hazard who follows them around. There's a hotel sequence in which they leave their room and this animal pads after them. They reach the elevator. They enter the elevator. The doors close. The lion looks up. Can't go in, so it turns left, goes down the staircase, we cut, the lion emerges down in the midst of a screaming group of people in the hotel lobby and rejoins Hepburn and Grant and walks out of the building. Well, now, of course, I've worked with trained animals, and no matter how well trained, no matter how docile, they're dangerous creatures, even small ones, and no studio is going to allow a valuable property, an actor or actress, to be placed in proximity to a lion or a jaguar. Now, what they did, and this is hard to describe, and I'll do the best I can in a few words, because as with mathematics, which require a good foundation before you can appreciate what they call the beauty of mathematical functions, it's hard to appreciate how these things are pulled off until you have a little instruction. But first, with the animal trainer, the camera was immobilized, tied down on a tripod, immobilized with chains so that it wouldn't move a fraction of an inch, and then in repeated, shot by shot, in the hotel corridor. And in repeated takes, the trainer would put a jaguar through its moves. It would walk down the hall. And, of course, the animal is a little unpredictable. One time, one take, it moves faster than another. It pauses. It goes ahead over and over, maybe a dozen different shots. Overnight, these are processed in the laboratory. Fine-grained master positive is prepared. With the timings which are produced on the basis of this first set of shots, Mr. Grant and Miss Hepburn were then brought back the next day. And working by stopwatch and by direction, a number of takes are made by them in such a manner that they precede the animal and never allow on the screen, visually, their bodies to interrupt or to overlap the position that was previously held by the animal. The camera is still locked down. Later, at leisure, in the optical effects department, using an instrument called an optical printer, which is capable of producing almost any kind of effect that the mind can imagine, a moving optical edge, which moves in 1/10,000th of an inch increments, on a first pass through the optical printer, prints only the shot of the jaguar, keeping the optical edge just ahead of its nose. And a record is kept of this. In the old days, you had to do it tediously. You had an apprentice who would make pages of these 1/10,000th of an inch increment moves. Today, a computer automatically records it, and motion control systems with stepper motors will simply make the machine do the same thing over and over. On the second run through the optical printer, you print the shot of Miss Hepburn and Mr. Grant, and the other side with the moving optical edge is blocked out. If it's done right, the optical edge, which is invisible, disappears, and the two parts of the picture merge, and one simply has a composite of an animal following 6 inches behind them down the hallway. Now, the audience never knew. Even experts for a long time didn't know how Lynn had pulled this off. Some people thought they really went to the hazard of allowing these two valuable performers to perform with a dangerous animal. Now, that's an example of what many special effects people are especially proud of. They have executed their art, their contribution to the art of illusion, and they have fooled the audience.
Let me ask you about another type of very common special effects, and this is one that you usually see as looking bad, which is something called the tank shot. Mm. I guess something like in a World War II submarine picture, you see boats floating, you say, this is in a bathtub.
Right.
What makes a good tank shot, or what makes a bad tank shot?
Well, there are two types of material. Miniatures, I might say, I don't like myself. Miniatures are ultimately self-defeating. Because what you do, you cut every few seconds to the submarine itself or whatever it is, the underwater, the cliched underwater vessel as it moves through the water. Then you cut into a full-size scale set and you have the depth charges and you rock the set. And all that looks fine, but then you have to cut back to the miniature again. If you leave any miniature on the screen long enough, the audience is going to see that it is a miniature. The problem is that you cannot miniaturize water or fire, and they are the two most difficult things to handle. You cannot make small water. You cannot make small fire. And there are many techniques. Oftentimes, these things are photographed dry, and then in the optical printer, the conventionalized waving distortion of underwater optical effects produced by a liquid environment are added optically. Well, I'll give you one example of an interesting failure, which was then corrected in an outstanding underwater film, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, that Walt Disney did many years ago. In the opening sequence, the Nemo submarine drives itself through the wooden hull of a merchant ship and sinks it. And there's a spectacular underwater scene as the metal submarine smashes through the metal-bound wooden ship. Well, they shot this dry. These are fairly large miniatures, of course. Both are suspended on wires, which are invisible against a neutral background, into which detail is later added, as well as foreground detail. The side of the wooden vessel is pre-scored. It's made of balsa. The heavier, more heavily constructed submarine is already on a wire which goes through the wooden vessel. And so with the camera operating at about 128 frames a second, high speed, which slows it down and gives a massive slow look to it, they threw the submarine through the air on its wires. It smashes through the balsa wood vessel, and that's the end of the shot. They looked at it on the screen, and remember, later they add the underwater tank effects, the liquid bubbles and wavy thing, and they realize that, of course, since it is a wooden vessel, the wood should float up to the surface. But, of course, it falls down to the earth, falls out of the shot. They had to shoot the film over this time. They turned everything upside down. They still ran at 128 frames, but they ran backwards. And when you see it on the screen, everything is again reversed again to its normal position. But this time, the chips fall to the earth, but they appear to fall up to the surface. It's the little details that make a shot work, and that's the problem because little details cost a lot of money.
Well, we only have about a minute left, but one other thing from your special effects background. What's the best blood to use?
Well, my golly, I don't know. I have an affection probably born of an indiscriminate, not too critical childhood. I still like the flood in the second Ten Commandments of Cecil B. DeMille. Mr. DeMille picked not the best special effects techniques. He picked an inferior matting process called the old Tom Howard process. So you get this obnoxious blue line around a lot of stuff. One of the recent issues of American Cinematographer magazine, for your listeners, they might want to get a copy of it, details the scenes behind the scenes of creating the colossal flood with Charlton Heston as Moses when he allows the sea to come back together. It is a combination of many, many different types of shots, many of which are really perspective shots, with water flowing in a different direction than in which it appears to be.
And how about blood? Is that ketchup?
Well, actually, blood falls under the area of prosthetic makeup. I have many friends in the field, a whole new generation of young makeup artists can do absolutely hideous things. Some of my best friends do the most awful things in their laboratory, and they have all kinds of techniques for that. But for the most part, that sort of thing is mechanical in nature, complicated but not visual. That is to say, it's not optically created.
Well, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you, and real interesting. Thanks a lot.
Been a pleasure to be here.
And we've been with Ray Fielding, who is on the faculty of the Department of Communication at the University of Houston. He's in the Philadelphia area now to lecture at a Freedoms Foundation seminar. They have another seminar coming up next week on literature, and their number, if you'd like to call, is 933-8825. In just a few minutes, we'll be joining National Public Radio for tonight's edition of All Things Considered, a reminder that we are in the third day of the Drive to Survive time for NPR, and let me give you a phone number for our studio here, 923-1234, if you can join us and pledge your support to National Public Radio. That's 923-1234. Well, contributing to today's Fresh Air was Ken Tucker. Abby Ginsberg has helped with the production of the show all week, and Maeve McGorn is the co-producer this week on Fresh Air. Fred Snyder was the technical supervisor. Tomorrow on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll hear the first in a program on the Bill of Rights series on individual rights and legal rights issues. And then at 4 o'clock, an interview which Terry Gross did for a while ago with Jules Pfeiffer. And he, of course, is the syndicated cartoonist for The Village Voice and has written a compilation of his cartoons, Jules Pfeiffer's America. Right now, sponsored by Superfresh, here's tonight's Shadow Traffic. My name is Danny Miller. See you tomorrow.
Good afternoon, everyone. Traffic a little bit heavy both directions crossing the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge due to an opening that lasted from 429 to 439. The Betsy Ross Bridge, your best bet is to get away from those delays. Schuylkill Expressway looks fine. Roosevelt Extension, about a 20-minute delay northbound through the detour.